But yeah.
You could also just record like a 30-second thing that says, we're not doing an introduction this week.
I could do that. I'll just put that in.
Okay.
I'll just say, here's a quote from me, and then I'll put that exact audio in.
See who's really paying attention.
See who's really paying attention. Hey, dear listeners, as Luke's wonderful snippet said, yes, we don't have any proper introduction this week because people are getting married, people are going to different cities, so we have an episode. You'll hear us all right after this talking about 30 Days of Night, and I hope you're all doing wonderful. And now I'm going to turn it over to Billy, Alex, and Luke. Over to you.
All right, week 4, Vampire Movie Month, Luke Mason. You wanted to pick an actually scary one. Mm-hmm. Did you succeed this week?
Scarier than any of the other ones we've done. So, of the four, it's the scariest. I wouldn't exactly call it scary, but I think it was more in that way than the others. So yeah, we've watched 2007's 30 Days of Night.
Yes.
I'd never seen it before. What it is in the kind of slogan for it. If you read one sentence about what it's about, you know what it's about. So I just picked it because it fit the bill.
It fit the bill. And yep, you sure did. I also hadn't seen this one, but I do remember seeing media for it when it was coming out. I think it's based off a graphic novel. Mm. And the premise of it gets dark in the Arctic at winter. Vampires love the dark. What if there was vampires during that time? Very isolated. It's got a recipe for a lot of good things. And did the movie pay off? We'll tell you what we think after the trailer. But Alex, what did you know about 30 Days a Night before we go into it?
I knew Josh Hartnett was in it. And that's it. Well, and I did know the premise of vampires in 30 Days of Night. So the title kind of gives it all away. Yeah, but that's it. Never watched it before.
All right. Well, I think we should go into it for our trigger warnings. Visit, of course, doesthedogdie.com. And for this one, so many dogs
die. All the dogs die.
Every single dog in this movie
dies. Beginning.
Does not make it out. Right off the bat, a risky move to start your movie with a bunch of animals dying, because historically people are less forgiving about animal death than they are about people dying in these movies. And so we'll get into it. But yeah, dogs. A lot of animal death. There's a lot of blood. This movie, if you're watching it, there's like a lot of really, really grating, screeching noises that are the vampires made by way of language that I found particularly grating. And there's also a couple scenes where kids are shown to be in harm or in danger. And there's even a scene where a child dies. It's a child vampire. So it's like, maybe that's not so bad. But still, if like seeing grown-ups killing a child is something that triggers you, you're warned. So yeah, I think that's about it. We are going to get into it. Here's the trailer for y'all. I'll make sure to mute down the screeches that I'm sure are going to happen in this trailer.
We need you at the station.
Copy that.
Board the windows. Try to hide. They're coming.
They? Who are they?
Somebody!
Help! I saw
too many teeth.
Too many vampires, you know?
Vampires don't exist, Jake.
That cold ain't the weather. That's death approaching.
They're tearing through everyone's home.
We can last the month.
30 Days of Night is a 2007 American horror film based on the comic book miniseries of the same name. The film was directed by David Slade and stars Josh Hartnett and Melissa George. The story focuses on an Alaskan town beset by vampires as it enters into a 30-day-long polar night. So fun fact about the director, he also directed one of the Twilight movies, I believe.
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
Which one?
I think Breaking Dawn Part 1, okay. But I could be wrong about that.
Still have yet to see any Twilight.
You're missing out?
Yeah, maybe one day. All right. This movie had a budget of $30 million. It made $75.5 million at the box office. At Rotten Tomatoes gives this movie 51%. And IMDb, like every other horror movie on IMDb, it's got a 6.6, which that just seems to be the rating for horror movies on IMDb. So, Luke, tell us your initial thoughts on 30 Days a Night.
My main criticism of this movie is just a little too long. But otherwise, I think this is a totally serviceable film. There's nothing like particularly awful about it, other than maybe the screeching, as you say. Honestly, the vampires reminded me more of the zombies from 28 Days Later than any other monster, which was just funny. Because this, honestly, if it didn't say vampires, I would have called this a zombie movie. And I thought this movie, probably its biggest strength were some of its artistic set pieces. Mm-hmm. There's the one scene where the vampires are kind of doing their mass killings early on, and it was just so fucking cool with like the contrast of the blood on the snow. I thought that was a really inventive, I don't think they had drones back then, but it looked like a version of a drone shot kind of going over this town with all these killings happening, which just looked gorgeous. You know, there's a line from a song I like. It's like a horror film. The plot sucks, but the killings are gorgeous. You know, that's kind of how I felt about this film. I thought the vampires themselves looked kind of interesting or cool. They clearly had some sort of code. It was interesting to follow a villainous type of creature that is communicating, but we don't know what they're saying, but they're clearly in some way cohering together.
Oh, did you not have subtitles for your vampire speech?
No.
Okay.
I didn't know.
They had some like English translations of it, but yeah.
And then the performances were fine. I mean, it was, you know, it was like those mid-2000s. There's a lot of like quick cuts and, you know, but I'm used to it, so it doesn't really matter. This movie is full of tropes and cliches, but whatever. After 150 plus, like this movie, the tropes and cliches of this movie are so much less obnoxious than other films. So I don't care that they're there. Okay. You know what I mean? Like, I just have so many other movies to compare it to that I think are significantly worse than this one. So
sure.
And yeah, I'd say the strongest part of this movie are some of the artistic set designs, and everything else is pretty average. But I didn't hate watching this movie.
Fair enough. This might seem like a non sequitur, but go with me. When did the Sin City movie come out?
Was it 2 years before this? 2005.
Yeah, so when you talk about that scene where it goes over and the vampires are like tearing into the town and you see this whole thing, it just gave me huge vibes of it being like a graphic novel splash page.
Oh, yeah.
Where it's like a full page, there's no dialogue, you just like, there's tons to look at. And so I was like, oh, this is like mid-2000s is like when graphic novels...
That was the heyday, right? Like this, 2005 to 2010 was the graphic novel heyday for movies and shows.
Yeah, Sin City... 300 was around this time as well, too. So
Watchmen was like, a couple years after.
Right, of course. And so just sort of seeing, I can imagine the exact like full double page spread of this town being in the comic books and then having them translate onto the film. I thought they did that really, really well. This movie, there was a lot of things that like the plot of this movie is so light that you could focus on everything around it. And unfortunately, that means like some of the continuity stuff that didn't match up really stuck out. I've been forever tainted in my mind thanks to the episode we did last year on summer camp where you know a movie's not that great if they say the characters' names over and over again. And I think they say Eben, who is Josh Hartnett's name, roughly 9,000 times in this movie.
Yeah.
And so just a lot of dialogue starting or ending with his name. Yeah, I think the premise is really cool. And yeah, vampires in the dark, an isolated outpost in the Arctic. It sounds perfect. I just think they didn't deliver as well as they could be. And there was some continuity things that made me think that either they were careless enough and didn't notice it, or they did notice and didn't care enough to fix it. But I'll get into that in a little bit. So, but I think you're right, Luke, in saying that this is definitely like a middle of the pack movie. It's not horrible, the worst movie, and it's by no stretch of the imagination one of the best ones we've done.
I would be rating this movie lower than I will if I hadn't seen all the other movies I've seen on this podcast.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. But Alex Wan, what did you think of 30 Days a Night?
It was pretty cool, and then it was also very lame, and then it was pretty cool again, and then I was like, oh, this is kind of lame, and then it was cool, and then I was like, well, this story is like total ass, and then it was over.
All right.
So what I'm saying is this is like a very fine, serviceable movie if you don't care about some things. And then if you care about everything, this movie's not great. But yeah, if you only care about some things, there's a lot of cool stuff to look at this movie.
There's definitely a lot of cool things to look at. So let's sort of talk about it. This movie opens up with a mysterious figure looking at a ship. And that is, I think, our clue that these vampires have come to the Arctic on this ship at the setting of the sun for the last day in the Arctic. And we meet our characters. They're all scrappy, tough people who've survived this month-long darkness before. And we're very quickly introduced to Sheriff Eben Oleson, who's played by Josh Hartnett. So let's talk about our boy, Josh Hartnett, in this movie. Alex, why don't you go first on your thoughts about our Josh Hartnett friend?
I generally like Josh Hartnett. I liked him in Black Hawk Down, and I think, what was he in?
He was in Pearl Harbor, too.
Yeah, and Black Dahlia. Like, he's kind of your prototypical, not like A-plus list actor, but like maybe like a A-minus B-plus, where you need like a decent looking person as your star.
Yeah, he was like a hot guy in a lot of teen comedies, I think.
Yeah. And I mean, he plays this role completely how you would expect the role to be played. He's the sheriff of a town that doesn't have a lot of people, that knows everybody, and he is seemingly good at his job and cares about people and his family and is going through personal life stuff. Mm-hmm. That's it.
He's good at his job, but he's not good at his marriage because he's too good at his job. Like, I love that trope.
But was it his fault, though? I don't think it was his fault. We don't get too many details about it, but I feel like it wasn't his fault, right?
No, I think she was just like, I don't actually want to be at Barrow, Alaska. I'd like to leave.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's kind of the everyman hero. Knows everyone in town, and he is having the worst day as this night falls. Not only is he trying to get everybody out who's leaving the town for the month, but also all the things that the vampire's little assistant is doing are throwing him off. Like, go ahead.
Yeah, so I just want to say that, like, you say he's having the worst day ever. I think that was one of my biggest problems with this movie, is like, it's 30 days of night, and from start of the movie till the end of the movie, it's those entire 30 days, but it's like, day one and night one is an hour and 40 minutes, and then we jump to day 7 or 18, and then, like, it's just, like,
that was funny.
Yeah, like, the whole idea that we're racing against, like, or we're trying to survive against time, because, you know, these vampires are only going to be here for 30 days, because, you know, that's when there's no sunlight. But then there's no feeling of time, whereas the time concept is in the title of the fucking movie, right?
Yeah, they have these conversations about, like, hey, we have to go from this house to this house. Let's do that right now. And then there's, like, a time jump of 8 days, and they're still at the same house. Yeah. I'm like, what? You just, like, the last dialogue was about leaving.
Yeah, it took out all sense of urgency, you know?
Yeah.
Probably, if this was going to be made today, they'd make it a TV show, so they could actually stretch it out, because I'm sure it's done better in the comic book.
Mm-hmm. You know? It must do, because, yeah, there's, like, it feels, you're right, there's, like, the first 40 minutes of this movie is night 0/night 1, and then the vampires do all of their rampaging, apparently, the first night, and then just, like, spend the rest of the night walking around, screeching at each other. But, yeah, there's, like, there's three different time cuts where it's, like, day 1 cuts to day 7, and then it cuts to night 18, and then it cuts to night 27. So they didn't even go in, like, tens. They could have done 7, 17, 27, or, you know, whatever. Or even just, like, 10, 20, 30. Like, here we are on the last day. Like, when they do the last time cut, and it's like, oh, day 27, they're like, okay, only 3 more days. But I don't know what that means. It could have been, you know, it also could have been 30 more minutes. Yeah, there's a lot of the time stuff that really felt kind of weird and wobbly. But, yeah, anyway, his bad day, which the vampire's
no good, very bad day.
Bad month. He had a bad month.
Well, he had his first bad day where the stranger has to prepare the way for the vampires, where we see him somehow stealing every satellite phone and burning them. He manages to kill every single sled dog in the entire town so nobody can get out. And what else does he do? He disrupts the power generator so they lose internet and computers. It's just like the systematic way of them cutting off this town even more than the weather is going to. I thought, like, wow, that's like ambitious for the first day. And everybody is like in a bustle trying to like move around and shut things down. Nobody's noticing the stranger until he goes to the bar and screams about getting whiskey and red meat and then causing a big scene. It's like, what are you doing, guy? What are you doing?
Yeah.
I enjoyed Josh Hartnett
as
an actor in this. I mean, he was fine. It didn't have to be him. Anyone could have played this role because it's actually a fairly wooden role. But I like him, dare I say, for nostalgia, because I actually think Black Hawk Down is one of the best war movies ever made. It's, I would say, top three for sure. And it was very formative for me. Yeah, I think I was 14 when it came out, and that was like just when I was starting to be allowed to watch movies like that. And he does there's so many characters in that film, but he's kind of the de facto protagonist. And actually, his name in that movie is Evan. So I thought it was funny that it was so close to Evan in this movie. I kept hearing it that way.
Evan.
Yeah. And I actually, last night, I just watched the new Guy Ritchie film. I think it's called
The Rudiger.
Yeah. Like Orson Fortune, and he's one of the main characters in that movie. So he's coming back, baby. Don't call it a comeback.
Do you think his last name was Flo in this movie?
Eben Flo?
Eben Flo.
Yeah, that'd be good. Like a Pearl Jam song with a lisp.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it was smart. I think it probably helped the budget of this movie to have a pretty famous Hollywood person in the lead role.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Because even this, like, this wasn't exactly the era of bigger budget horror movies yet.
No, so we weren't going to get our franchises that we know and love today,
mm-hmm.
the new ones. It was mostly, like, I think, remakes of, like,
I mean, he was kind of a, stuff. I would say he was a bit of an understated badass in this movie, and that was fine. I enjoyed that.
He's an understated badass. He's also the only person who, in the 30 days, changes the amount of facial hair he grows.
Hey, or okay, you know what? Some of us can't grow it, okay?
Or some of them already had big beards at the start.
Yeah, some of them already had big beards, so we can excuse that. But I noticed that, like, the whole time passing thing, like, even his brother, who's, like, supposed to be 15, but it's like, you can still grow some facial hair.
No, some of us can, okay?
All right. Okay. Oh, I touched a nerve. Well, some of us don't want to, okay? It's... And I noticed that, and I also noticed that his girlfriend, Stella, her hair, 4 weeks without washing that hair, it looked way too nice. Mm-hmm. Like, wasn't greasy, it didn't get all clumpy, like, nobody looked dirty enough for it to be, you know, four weeks without running water or showers or anything.
I think some of these points are actually making me remember a critique of the movie 300 that I think actually really well applies to movies based on comic books or graphic novels, is that I remember some reviewer gave a really bad review of the movie 300, basically saying there's nothing historically accurate about this movie at all.
I'm shocked.
Yeah, right? What? And the counter reviewer said, look, this isn't a movie about the Battle of Thermopylae. This is a movie about a comic book about the Battle of Thermopylae, right?
Right. And okay.
This isn't a movie about vampires attacking an Arctic town. This is a movie about a comic book about vampires attacking a town, right? And so I actually have a lot more, like, it's like a philosophical point. I actually have a lot more grace for a movie that's already, that's based on an adaptation that's already not going to be accurate, because a whole point of a comic book is much more the visuals, right? Or the visuals are a huge element in, and the dramatization and the like intentional fiction or the intentional discontinuities of what would it be like if a bunch of zombie vampires attacked this town, you know? It's like
I believe they were just vampires, though, Luke.
Yeah, I know, but they behaved like the 28 Days Later zombies in a way that I've never seen any other creature behave that isn't called a zombie. So,
right.
Okay.
That's all I mean. And so, yeah, if this movie wasn't based on a comic book, it would suck a lot more than it does in my mind.
That's fair.
But since it is based on a comic book, I just don't know how many authors of comic books are going to think about their female protagonist's hairstyle a month into the apocalypse. I sure wouldn't.
The good ones will.
I sure wouldn't, and I think that that's like part of the bias of being someone who doesn't have long hair or much hair.
Yeah,
you know.
Fair enough. Yeah, you don't think about it if it's not there. But
yeah.
It was just very funny. Like they went so far to like make them look a little bit like grimier mm-hmm. and sweatier, and like the makeup changed at all. Like it wasn't movie star gorgeous makeup the whole time. But I was just like, oh, okay, I noticed this. This is silly. This is a little funny thing. But you're right. It's based on a comic book, and as I try to remind myself, if there's things that you don't like in movies for continuity, just imagine that it's set in a universe where that doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Or that doesn't happen. And so maybe this 30 Days of Night, because if that's the hill I'm dying on, there's a lot of like geographical inaccuracies I could point out that would be way more applicable to it being set on Earth. But
well, because
this is just a town where people don't get greasy.
I mean, if you in the like schema of fiction, comic books are even more fictitious than most works of fiction, right? Like it's yeah. that much more exaggerated. That's why it's a comic book version of this, right? Or a caricature. Yeah. And so again, when you consider the execution of a movie that's based on a comic book versus a novel, you're gonna I just have a lot more grace for the stupidity of it all, because that's baked into it. I think
right yeah, it's a comic book. It's a world where, you know, a female comic book character can give herself a haircut with a hunting knife and come out the next frame like perfectly mm-hmm. even and layered and
ready for the ball,
you know, blow dried and everything. It's yeah, so it's fine. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to bother me. But I did notice it. Yeah, and Eben as the hero of the town, he's just such a good guy, you know. We get to see him like interacting with everybody. He's like friendly to everyone. He loves his little brother. He even likes the hermit that lives on the side of the town and only knows how to show it to him by writing him a citation for his tow truck. Just be like, hey, just let him know he's still part of us. It's like, okay.
There were a lot of Chekhovs in this, in the first act of this movie. There was Chekhov's hermit with the big truck that can save them later. There mm-hmm. was Chekhov's grinder in the factory.
That thing had a name, but I just called it the Monster Mash because I couldn't remember what they said.
Yeah, exactly.
There was Chekhov's inhaler.
Yep.
Chekhov's inhaler. There was Chekhov's tractor with a giant chainsaw blade that
exactly
came back. Yeah. Trencher, I think it was called.
Well, I mean, yeah. Chekhov exploded all over this movie.
Chekhov's UV light is damaging to vampires.
I actually really liked that scene. Just because I like in horror movies, especially if you're dealing with creatures that are supernatural or, you know, made up, having things around to be able to beat them that are just part of the natural world is obviously nonsense, mm-hmm. but still kind of fun. And like in less ridiculous movies that are more survival based on like other people trying to hurt you, or like in Hush, I just loved the setup of like the alarm being part of what she mm-hmm. uses to beat him, right? Like there's just these things that might be around the house that are total made for something completely different, but because you've like isolated one variable that's really important in this movie, namely vampires, the fact that there's a UV light that grows weed for their cancerous aunt or grandma was like, I just like shit like that. I enjoy repurposing of items in movies for the bigger need based on that isolated variable that become really important.
Yeah, and it sometimes feels like they do a little bit of like mental traveling where they're like, okay, so we know that we need some way to get a UV light. What would be a reason there's a UV light, and how do we seed mm-hmm. that earlier on? Okay, so maybe indoor plants. Grandma grows pot. Okay, yeah. Great. Like now we have that. Now we have that tool to use later. But yeah, it's like making use of everything mm-hmm. in your surroundings to help you solve a problem, which is it's part of the creativity that is human beings. And I even liked how when he like shines it and he gets the one vampire, he gets the like girl vampire, he kills her. He's even like aware enough that like, oh, these vampires are going to kill this generator, so this will not be an option anymore.
Yeah.
And it's not like a horror movie where somebody has a baseball bat, takes out one bad guy, and then just throws the bat away, even though it's still perfectly good. Like there's a reason mm-hmm. you can't have this be how you defeat all of them. You can defeat one of them, but you can't defeat all of them. I like that they went the extra mile to be like, uh-oh, the power's going to get turned off, so we won't have access to this tool anymore.
Although now I'm thinking about it, why the hell did they think UV light and not make a single wooden stake? They didn't make a single wooden stake.
because Luke, all of the wooden stakes were in the bar in From Dusk Till Dawn, so they didn't have any.
Right. even though all those houses were made of wood.
Shh, no, 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 no. No, no, no. Yeah, no stakes. No. There's no stakes in this movie.
Yeah, no stakes.
Okay, so anything else about Josh Hartnett? Eben, his last name is Olesen, not Ebon Flow, I'm afraid.
Lame.
In that case, I want to talk about the love interest of this movie, Stella, his girlfriend. And
I believe it was his wife.
His wife slash...
I think her middle name was Ella, too. So Stella Ella Olesen at one point.
Stella. Yay, that was really good. I really liked that. I enjoyed that a lot. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So Stella Ella Olesen, my favorite scene with her is her character's trying to get out of Barrow for the month. She's trying to get to the airport. It's the last flight, and boy, oh boy, does she pull up to that closed airport like a 90s dad coming to his kid's recital late. I love that visualization of her, you know, she gets waylaid, driving up so fast to this obviously closed airport and doing the thing where it's like, I missed it. I don't know. It's very, very funny when characters get, you know, you can tell that they're not going to make it, and they still, like, go the distance.
Yeah.
What do we think about our Stella? Stella!
She was fine.
She was in the movie.
Exactly. She was in the movie.
She was in the movie.
I think I just... One of the lame parts of this movie is the very end when she's like stuck under the car with that kid. Who the fuck is that kid?
Where did that kid come from?
Where did that kid come from? How come that kid did not die the first 27 days?
Yep. No, don't ask.
I call bullshit.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So go on. Continue your point.
That's it. It's like...
Oh.
I feel like her entire character was love interest who happens to be competent, but then dies because of some fucking stupid reason. Like, why the fuck is this kid out there? It's been 27 days, and you're telling me that kid hasn't been dead? Yeah, okay.
Especially because earlier in the movie, they saw that the vampires were using humans as bait. So why wouldn't this kid also be bait? Mm-hmm. It's like, no, this one, because it's a kid, I know vampire code. They would not use a kid as bait. They got code.
They would not use kid as bait, but they have kid vampires, but not they're not like that. They're not going to use a human kid.
No.
Like, I don't know. I've never read the comic, but like basically the plot point of putting her underneath the car and her needing to get rescued because the town's going to blow up for this fucking kid. Like, give me a better reason. Like, I know like kids are like, oh, like characters in movies will do whatever they can to save the random kid. But like this random kid should have been dead days ago, weeks ago. Fortnights ago.
I wrote that that kid's name was Gail, last name, a hope for the future, a metaphor representing the hope of the future, which is, you know, like, you know, in Train to Busan, how he saves his daughter. So it's like, oh, humanity has a chance to keep going because we protected the kids or whatever. So I felt like that, but it was just like, there is no indication of her at all the first 30 days of this movie, and then she's just there.
Yeah, well, I would have liked it, like, it would have made way more sense if the kid was just with the group the whole time.
Yeah.
Right? But then it's like, no, we're just going to find a random kid 27 days in, and that'll be that. And that'll be your motivation, Stella Ella Olesen.
Well, yeah, because the only other time we've seen a kid is earlier when they're in the general store, or the whatever, utility store or whatever, and they find that kid who is feasting on somebody, and she's a vampire, and she's like real evil and can speak English and is all sassy, and nobody knows her. So I was just like, oh, is this like a second child? It was just very confusing to have a new character be introduced at the end of the movie. It's like bad writing. You don't need to have another character, you know, at the end.
You know what, maybe the filmmakers thought, you know what, we can add a new character and it's only day one, but they didn't realize it was actually day 27 because it all the fucking looks the same and there's no continuity.
I think this is another good example of why this would have made a better TV show, because you just have way more time to flesh out. Like, if this was a TV show, we would have had at least like a third, if not a half of an episode showing the 27 days from this character's perspective of how they actually survived this long. Like they do in all the other shows, right? Like they do that in Lost. They do that in The Walking Dead. They do that in all of these kind of apocalyptic type shows where when they do introduce a new character, they show where that character has been, right?
Yeah, they give it.
Whereas a movie,
bit of like
you
that.
Just don't have time to do that. Yeah. In a
movie. Mm-hmm. And it feels like it felt like stuff got cut. It felt like there was plot points that got cut and explanations that were cut. There was also a plot line with two of the survivors who appeared to be a father and a son, and the father had dementia or Alzheimer's and kept trying to leave. And so that like introduces stakes of this old man who, through no fault of his own, is going to like slip into false memories and think things are better than they are. And lead the vampires to them. And so it's like, oh, this is like tense, but that also didn't feel like it was developed. It was just like, okay, we've got the survivors in this attic. And then Isaac is the old man is just like, I gotta get out of here. Ah, I'm leaving.
And I know it's super cheesy, but I still got some satisfaction out of the fact that the movie killed off all of the annoying survivors. Like all of the ones who were a bit asshole-ish or mean or like trying to hurt the other ones, they just died. It's like, yes.
Yeah.
Very good.
It's like good.
Very good. Good choice, movie. Yeah.
That's good. Yeah. Yeah. And I think getting back to Stella and her saving the kid, again, it's a little bit of how do we write it so that Josh Hartnett can inject himself with vampire blood and turn into a vampire to beat the boss? Because if Stella's there, she's going to say no or not let him or prevent him from doing it. So we need to get her out of the picture for a minute. Okay, there was a kid who survived because movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, that's his only way to save her is to sacrifice himself. And then they stare at the sunrise, which was the first place they met. And he burns up, which I thought that was kind of cool.
That was a nice ending.
Him burning up.
Well, I think that's a good like shot to remind us like what is actually quite strong about this film, which are the visuals. Obviously, the killing scenes we already talked about, but I thought the vampires themselves looked pretty unique and actually great. Yeah. They looked both human and not human at the same time. There's a kind of uncanny valley feeling looking at them, I thought, because they're clearly bipedal humanoids, but their faces are all wrong. And so whatever technology or maybe prosthetics they used for that was awesome. And, you know, between the settings of like that factory and the different houses and the store and all of the different ways that industrial type things like vehicles, like all of it, I thought was really, really well done in this. Mm. Which is the point, you know, comic book is often the visuals. So, yes, the acting, the script, the plot are all quite weak in this film. But I do think it leaned in more into its strength, which was the visuals.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And the vampires, they did look very unique as far as vampires go. It didn't look like they were vampires who had the ability to pass as fully human.
Yeah, they weren't like Fright Night. Debonair.
Yeah.
Gentlemen vampires. They can't like,
or like the Buffy vampires can like, you know, when they shift and they get their face and they get their like big eyebrow ridges and fangs and cheekbones and stuff. It looked like they were always in monster mode, which made me kind of wonder, because of course I'm wondering things in this movie, is like, how did these vampires exist at all in a society with people ever? Like, obviously, the Arctic is isolating and they can get away from there. But judging on the stranger's accent at the very start, he was from the southern states, Louisiana. He had a very thick Cajun accent, which was very strange. So I was just like, how are these vampires interacting at all in places that are more populated? Because there's no way they can, like, interact. They've got big, long claws and they don't speak English and their mouths are just shark teeth. So I just had that thought crossing my mind the whole time. But speaking of the vampire language, this movie was filmed in New Zealand.
Oh.
And David Slade and the head vampire, played by Danny Houston.
Angelica Houston's half-brother.
That's how I recognized him.
They worked on the language. They worked on inventing this like fictional language that had like guttural noises and screeches and animal sayings. And so they gave me the idea that these vampires were less like, you know, the suave, debonair, sexy vampires that we've seen, and more just like a ravenous pack of wolves or velociraptors or something that survived by, I don't know, just like striking in the night and then disappearing and hiding. But it's still, it made me wonder, like, why are they wearing clothes? Why are they bothering with these trappings of humanity when they're so obviously not? They're other creatures and they've managed to survive for centuries without ever thinking, hey, what's... Let's see what the Arctic has for dinner. Until then,
well, wasn't it like a thing of opportunity or a killing of opportunity? Because it was like, this is easy because we can be outside for 30 whole days.
Yeah, and I think they arrived on like there's a scene at the start where there's a boat shipwrecked, and I think the idea is they arrived that way. But there's no reason as to like why they thought
a bunch of fobs. Am I right?
Yeah. Why do they catch this boat into the?
There's a comment in the movie about how some of the human characters think that the vampires do this kind of systematically every year. That like the next,
well,
the,
next year they're going to go back to the,
go to the next, following the next towns, furthest, right? The next closest town south, and then the next year they're going to go to the next one. All these other towns. So I guess we maybe presume this is what they've been doing all over the globe. Like maybe maybe they only need a month of feeding to be able to survive for the other 11, and they've maybe ransacked every town in Siberia thus far, and Norway and northern Finland and Sweden, who knows, right?
Yeah, maybe.
And so now that they've done that over all the centuries, they're going to come into Alaska or whatever.
And then they were going to, like, the idea was they're going to burn the town to make it look like an accident to hide all the evidence that there were vampires, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so that feels like, in that case, you need, like, a spooky old character who has stories that nobody tells, or being like, I remember seeing a town that was burnt to ground, like, 10 years ago, and kind of, like, lay that there's this historical precedent that nobody believes, but,
I kind of preferred it not to, though, in this movie. It was like, it was just so self-explanatory. There was like nothing like, what's the lore of these vampires? It was like, no, they're vampires. They need to eat. They need to kill. They went to this town because there's no sunlight. And then they're going to move on to the next one.
If it was a TV show, there'd be more lore building. But again, it's like, it's kind of the construction of the medium. Movies just need to make their money back. And
yeah.
Action makes more money than lore.
So you said, when I said Danny Houston is the vampire, you said you recognize him from something. So what movie did you recognize him from, Luke?
Oh, I he's just a character actor from a lot of different X-Men things.
He was William Stryker.
Yeah, he was also in a couple seasons of Yellowstone, that TV show.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, he's just been in lots.
Ah, the old person show.
Yeah, he's been in a lot of things. I can't really remember what else, but it's just, you know, he's a face you recognize all the time.
I specifically recognize him from X-Men Origin Wolverine. He was the guy who was in charge of adamantiuming Hugh Jackman.
Yeah, he plays a villain a lot of the time. He's kind of got that smarmy feel to him in a lot of shows, so he can pull it off pretty well.
He looks like government agent, like duplicitous government agent. That's right. Is just like the way his body shape and face and haircut look, which I thought was interesting for him being this, like, in my notes, I called him Vampire Daddy because he's like the most human presenting, I guess, apart from his hands. But he had the most human looking face. He didn't seem like he had the prosthetics. He had the teeth and he had the bloodshot sort of shark eyes, but he didn't have any other stuff on his face. So I guess maybe he could have passed in some way or interfaced a little bit more with society, whereas these children of his or his pack was more just like rabid dogs.
Well, as we learned from, what was it, the one we did last week? Lost Boys. Got the head vampire is always a little bit trickier, a little bit sneakier, a little bit more able to blend in, perhaps. So.
So again, the middle-aged white businessman was the bad guy all along.
And no one even saw it coming.
What? Just one more note about the vampires before we move on to something else. I really thought it was funny the way they depicted the feeding of this, like the way the actors physically maneuvered, and it was just like they looks like they clenched a blood pack in their teeth and then just shook their heads back and forth really, really fast and made like rah, 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 noises while they were like biting people. I thought it was very, very silly, you know, not like the biting and draining the blood slowly. It was just like messy. So messy.
Yeah, that's kind of what I guess passively enjoyed about this, of all of the movies we've done, not even just for this month for vampires, but vampires in general. Like these vampires are the most distinct from all the other vampires we've done. So it felt, even though it was kind of straightforward, it felt a little fresher than the other ones. I'm going to wine and dine and suck your blood 69, you know, kind of thing. Like
dinner for two.
This is the most modern one we've done out of the four, too, right?
Of this month, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I thought it was, it's not like we've never seen a rabid pack of things before in these movies, but I think what's different between vampires and zombies, obviously, is that vampires can, like, communicate and are, for lack of a better term, civilized. And there was clearly a civilizational aspect to these vampires amongst themselves.
There was at least a hierarchy.
Yeah, which you're not going to have with zombies. And so that was a interesting hybrid, I thought.
Now, we haven't watched the 28 Days or 28 Weeks Later movie.
Which kind of blows my mind, actually.
Which, like, maybe we should get to it. But and feel free to say no if this is a spoiler. But you said that the vampires remind you of the zombies in there. So were the zombies in 28 Days Later, did they have a capacity for speech and communication, or were they mindless?
I don't think that they did. It's been a long time since I've seen it, but I'm pretty sure that they are.
They had the monkey virus.
Yeah, they get the monkey virus, so they're basically just total rabid animals.
Okay, so that more their physicality is.
And how they attacked, and how fast they were. Right, like that's one of the things that in 28 Days Later, the zombies are very fast. They don't.
Same with
amble. They sprint.
What's that Brad Pitt zombie movie?
World War Z.
World War Z Top.
Yeah, I mean, what was would be more horrific if it were possible was that they had this kind of rabid energy but could communicate and hunt like humans, right? Mm-hmm. Like imagine, it's like predators, right? It's like they have this super intelligence, but they're also physically stronger and faster and better than humans, you know? So like that's actually quite terrifying.
Yeah, and like I like that we get to see that they have some sort of sense of tactics where they have, I think it's on... you know, one of the knights, or maybe the first knight, who knows, but they have this bait human that they send out, and you know, she's like, oh, help me, trying to lure other people to protect her while they are circling around. I thought that just showed that they have a sense of tactics. And to get onto the comment you made, Luke, about their strength and how they're stronger than humans, one thing I really appreciated with the fight with the vampire child was that the child was not impossibly stronger than the humans. They were able to overpower her. They were able to hold her down and dispatch her.
It took a few of them, but they were able to do
it. And they fucked her up.
Because it's not even just that they're stronger. It's just that, like zombies, they're feral. So they don't actually... It's not that they... I mean, who knows what zombies feel. But it's not like they don't feel pain. It's that they're not deterred by trauma. Like, blunt force trauma just doesn't deter a feral creature, right? Like, so you can't really injure it as much as you have to kill it.
Yeah. And I thought that was because, you know, that's one of our gripes in movies is when there's a kid who's possessed by something and they shove a grown human back 20 feet. And you're just like, how is a child, like the muscles aren't strong enough. And so I just thought that was a nice touch that they were strong enough to like hold down this kid, even though she was thrashing it. And
the cool thing about Josh Hartnett is that when he became half vampire, he became strong enough to punch through the back of Danny Houston's head. That was pretty cool too.
Right?
That was
right
cool.
Through his face. You know, they say if you want to punch somebody in the nose, you should aim for the back of their head. Yeah. And I guess Josh Hartnett took that literally.
Yeah. Like I was surprised for a second when that happened because I was like, oh wow. And then I like you see his bloody hand, I'm like, and then it's just for a second. I'm like, is he holding a stake or something? Like, is he like have Wolverine claws or something? Mm-hmm. And then they go back to his hand, it's like, oh no, it was just his hand. I'm like, damn.
Just punched it so hard.
Yep.
Yeah, and then I like that he kills the daddy vampire, punches him right through the face, and then immediately all the other vampires are like, we're out of here, goodbye, and they just scatter off into the wilderness. So
anarchy.
See, I would have thought like it would have been some kind of like Dothraki thing where Josh Hartnett, Evan becomes like daddy vampire, but then he's... Nope.
He don't want it.
They just left it at
that. He don't want it.
He doesn't want to be king. He's like Jon Snow. He doesn't want to be king.
Opposite.
Lame.
Like the anti-Simba.
Yeah. Exactly. The anti-Simba. We couldn't say it any clearer than that. Speaking of that fight, that final fight, there's a very large continuity error that I noticed, and it involves one of the other henchmen vampires who was kind of the bald guy who was a little bit squatter.
Yeah.
He always had like blood around his face that I called him Bloodbeard because I couldn't find any name for him. So he's the one that goes into the Monster Masher in the factory, which is beautifully set up earlier on where they're like, check out this giant bunch of teeth that are just grinding away. Okay, time to go back to doing whatever else we're doing. It's like, oh, someone's going into that thing for sure. But he goes into that machine at the end when Billy the deputy sacrifices himself. They tosses him in. We see him get like chopped up. And then in the final fight scene, that same vampire is still there. Like he's just like, they shot it out of order and he was in the scene when Eben faces off with Marlo, I think was the daddy vampire's name. So I was like, huh, that's the same guy. And just in case I was being actor blind or not recognizing it, and there's two bald vampires, I looked it up, and this is credit to IMDb trivia, so I still might be wrong, but it did confirm it in the movie of like that being a continuity error where that actor shows up after he's supposedly dead. So
what you gonna do?
What you gonna do? It's a comic book, it doesn't matter. Yeah.
I mean, we're recording this at Easter. If Easter says anything, is that people can come back to life, no problem.
Oh. He is risen. He just like mushes back together underneath the monster masher. And he's like, I was fine after actually. This is not technically a stake, so it didn't kill me. And these teeth don't look like they're made out of silver, so.
One of my favorite South Park episodes is around Easter, where I think it's Kyle's parents are having marital troubles, and it's because Kyle's dad is having a hard time getting Reza erections. And so they crucify Cartman so that Gerald can get Reza erected so that their marriage is saved. So I guess resurrections are important to everyone. Maybe that would have helped. We don't know, Eben and Stella. We didn't really get a reason for anything. So, you know, just it's just funny. They leave Cartman on a cross for 3 days so that Gerald can get resurrected.
It's so rarely, Luke, that you stumble over your words in your stories, and it's just kind of funny to see when you like lose a little bit of like the plot, you know, trying to relate it to Eben and Stella. You're just like, I'm gonna abandon it. Go back to Cartman.
It seemed less likely. I realize it doesn't seem like that's what their problem was.
No. No. Their problem was they had zero chemistry as a couple.
I think. Yes. That's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
So, all right. I was disappointed in the way the monster masher was used. Thing that for its big setup, I thought we were going to get more people, more vampires falling into that thing as a way to like thin out the herd a little bit. But the fact that it was this whole giant machine that can chop through anything and it only took down one vampire was, I was disappointed.
One vampire and a hand.
Right. So 1.01.
What was that character's name? Billy?
That was Billy. Billy the sheriff.
That murdered his family?
Oh, God, yeah. That was
redeemed himself by helping Evan? Like, what? What were you going for, movie?
Such a weird plot line to include where the fact that he... I mean, I get it. That, like, sense of isolation and madness and darkness and stuff, you know, make people do irrational things. And if he thought he was saving his family from a worse fate, it's not a great reason. But there also wasn't any like setup in the movie that led to that. Like when we met Billy on his rounds with Eben at the start, he was like a friendly guy, cracking jokes, seemed fine. And then like he disappears for all of the movie until the very end when they find him holed up in his house and he's unfortunately like killed his wife and child, which is just like, oh my God, a movie. I'm not ready to be like devastated at the loss of this family at this man's hand, this desperate man. I'm ready for more vampire screeches and silliness.
Mm-hmm.
They probably did it better in the comic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or they would do it better in the TV show.
I feel like that could be the epitaph of this movie. It's better in the comic.
Well, there's been other sequels to this movie, hasn't there?
There's been at least one. Uh-huh. And it's like Stella going down to L.A. I read the synopsis, going down to L.A. to kill all these vampires who are now in L.A. for some reason. But they recast her, so it's a different actress.
So Stella Ella Olofsson's L.A. Adventure.
I think it's called 30 Days of Night, The
Dark Days.
Dark Days, yeah.
And it's straight to DVD.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what are the vampires? That's not 30 Days of Night in L.A. That's the City of Lights. Isn't that the whole thing? It's light all over the place?
Well, except that...
So that's the City of Angels.
Again, at night, they can... It's not that they can't live in lights. It's that they can't live in sunlight.
Right.
So they can still do their night shit.
One of the questions people ask on Google is 30 Days of Night based on a true story? How? How could that be based on a true story? It's vampires. What are you talking about?
Well, I mean, you could take it as a Cold War metaphor.
Sure.
There was a prequel miniseries and a sequel miniseries as well.
Oh, okay. Well, we won't watch them for this show. So...
Don't make promises, Billy, unless you know you can keep them.
I know I can keep this one.
Okay.
I won't pick it. How's that? I promise I won't pick any more 30 Days of Night properties for this show. I can't speak for sure for Luke or Alex, but I know it won't come out of my mouth. One other thing I wanted to mention before we wrap up into our final thoughts, again, getting back to the visuals, when Billy starts turning into a vampire and we see him get decapitated, I really thought that scene was effective and the effect looked pretty good as far as on-screen decapitations go. Like, I thought the effects were suitably gory and gross.
Mm-hmm. Well, like the song says, the killings are gorgeous.
You've mentioned that song.
It's called Pulp Fiction by Motion City Soundtrack.
Alrighty. So, do we have final thoughts, Luke Mason? Anything last you want to talk about for 30 Days a Night?
No, not really. I'll save it for the rating.
Save it for the rating. Okay, Alex, any more final thoughts?
No, I'll save it for the rating.
All right. I also don't have any final thoughts, and I might remember something for the rating, but we'll see. Let's go into the scariest part of the movie then. So back to you, Luke. Scariest part.
It's interesting because, like, I guess there's a few jump scares that are effective. You know, I can't really pick out which one. And this movie is not, conventionally speaking, scary, although it is scarier than any of the other ones we did for Vampire Month, but that's pretty low bar for this month, I'd say. I will pick the two or three generic jump scares that I don't really remember when they happened, but I know that I jumped a little when they did happen.
Okay, just like general jump scares.
I can't
general
even remember which part of the movie they happened in, but I know it happened a couple times.
Yeah, and the jump scares were, they all fell into that realm of not necessarily giving you a lot of tension and a release of a jump scare, but more so like, oh, the music just dropped out here. Oh, there was a really loud noise accompanying this jump scare. Now my body convulsed involuntarily. Yeah,
I would say as far as tension goes, the most tense part of the movie for me was just that horrible decision that Eben and Stella make to go drive around to go get something early on, where they're just like immediately attacked and like, what the fuck did you think was going to happen here? And then, of course, yeah, they're ex machina saved by whatever that guy, Mark Boone, that actor.
Beauregard or whatever his name is.
Was he in Star Wars?
He was in an episode of The Mandalorian.
He's
also been like a Christopher Nolan darling. He's been in a few Christopher Nolan movies. Like he was in, I think he was in Batman Begins and Memento.
Oh, he's like one of the mobsters, yeah, right? Or the corrupt cops?
He's a corrupt cop, yeah. He's the guy who asks, you don't like falafel or your kids can't eat falafel?
Right.
Falafel's great.
Before he shows up and ex machinas them, I forgot about him, so I didn't really know how Eben and Stella were going to survive this because it looked pretty unsurvivable. And that would be the most tense moment of the movie for me.
Well, I wouldn't say it was ex machina, right? Because he showed up at the start of the movie.
I know, but it's like he just...
It was a Chekhov's gun.
Yeah, it was too early for the Chekhov's big vehicle moment. So I just kind of forgot about him. That's all.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he saved them. Yeah. And even though that whole choice was predicated on like a completely flimsy reason for them to go out in their car. It's like, you've seen that they can track down noises. What are you doing in a noisy car? Anyway, my scariest part of the movie is just like the completely psychological traumatizing part of like, you find out what happened to Billy's family. And it was like, he did it, which was just like, oh no, that's so sad because there's been historical things, speaking of true stories, where people in isolated moments or in like blizzards or something, like just stave off starvation or a worse fate, people have like killed their family members through some sort of misguided reason, and it's always just like, ugh, so bad. So I'm picking that.
Wasn't his reason like a euthanasia kind of thing, where it was like, save you from dying to the vampires, I'll kill you myself.
Yeah, like I said, he had a reason, but it's still just like, ugh. Hard to, you know,
it's a hopeless contemplate. It's a hopeless reason.
Yeah, a hopeless reason. Alex, what is your scariest part?
Probably with the kid vampire, when like obviously you know it's a kid vampire and you can tell it's a kid vampire, but then when the kid vampire starts talking, I'm like, this is way too articulate to be a regular vampire.
Yeah, why did that kid be able to like talk so well and the other ones were just like velociraptors?
Yeah, when the kid vampire starts talking.
Alrighty, so good, scariest parts. Let's now rate this thing and wrap up the episode for the week. So Luke Mason, it's your candle to light. What do you got?
Well, there's a lot of things, obviously, that could be chosen for this film to rate it out of. But I'm gonna go a little bit more meta and just say we're going to rate this out of 5 underutilized Ben Foster performances, who is the original Stranger and was maybe not famous yet, but he is the second most famous person in this movie, and they just didn't use him enough, I thought.
Oh, the Cajun guy?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, that was Ben Foster.
Yeah.
What else has he been in?
Well, he was in Hell or High Water. He was the brother. He was Chris Pine's brother in Hell or High Water. And he was in Hostiles, a movie from 2017 with, and I'm blanking, but he's been in a very famous role. I think he was nominated for an Oscar for one of his movies in the last like 5 years. So he's like just a perfect kind of small time bad guy type of attitude. So anyway, I know he wasn't really famous yet by 2007, so I get it. But I just was like,
is in 310 to Yuma.
Yeah, that's right. He was also the yeah, which was probably his breakout role, which I think was the same year as this movie, actually. So
He was in Emancipation. Mm-hmm. That's what 2022 movie with Will Smith.
Yeah. Anyway, I just think he's a great actor, so they underutilize him. So
okay, underutilize Ben Foster's.
Yeah, I think objectively this movie is not very good in the totality of what would make a movie good. But based on a comic book, it gets a few more grace points from me out of everything because it did accentuate the comic book points, which I think a fan of the comic books might have enjoyed.
Mm.
I'm going to give this one, I would say, 2.85 underutilized Ben Foster performances out of 5.
2.85. Excellent. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I'm right there with you. I think this movie is very middle of the road. Lots to look at. Not much in the way of plot. And unfortunately, the fact that there's so little plot really does make some of the continuity and some of the just like nonsense stick out a little bit more. Whereas if there's a bit more of a story, you kind of like gloss over those things. So I think I'm right there with you. I think I'm going to be a 2.75 for me out of 5.
That's not right there with him.
Alex is fighting today.
that's
a few points off.
Except, but if we assume it is just an intentional continuity error, it's actually quite flush with the points Billy's making.
There you go.
Okay.
All right, Alex, give us your rating.
Sure. This movie was fine. It was cool, and then it was not cool, and then it was cool, and then it was lame, and then it was cool, and it was like, where the fuck did this kid come from? And then it was, but it was like really cool to look at. And it was a neat setting, like, you know, Polar Night. That's cool. That's neat.
That axical tilt.
Were neat.
It's gonna get you.
The Hotline Miami bird's eye view thing was cool. And then, yeah. That's it. So I'm not going to be right there with you, Luke, but I am going to give it a 2.8 underutilized Ben Foster.
Oh, that's like right between both of ours. So that's like pretty close to being right there with us.
Yeah, but it's not.
I think Alex is just trying to be mean.
Oh, my God. Oh, thank you for restoring my sense of humor.
You're welcome.
All right. Well, then. Let's move into a something to cheer section. Something to cheer for the ages. Here we are, end of April. What are we cheering? Luke Mason, go.
I have, big news, flashing news. This is a non-trivia related cheer. I am...
Whoa.
Yeah, stop the press. Yesterday, I went with some friends who have children, and we watched the new Super Mario Brothers movie. And it is a movie made for children. And so it's quite, again, the story is quite bland, which is fine, because the way that they're able to portray all of these beloved characters from the video game is just awesome. They were so funny. Mm. There was, for someone like me, there's 100 Easter eggs in this movie of all of the auxiliary games. That there's like a momentary cameo of Diddy and Dixie Kong with Chunky Kong, you know. And so there's just so many little nods and winks to some of the other games. And the music, obviously they had a lot of the Nintendo music, but they also had a great soundtrack of like actual songs throughout it. It's frenetic, it's kinetic, the color vibrancy is beautiful, because it's the music and the visuals that really make a lot of those Mario games, because the especially the original platformers that I fell in love with are very basic. So totally a great movie for what it is. And Jack Black as Bowser was incredible.
Oh man, he's killing it.
He was incredible. It was so good. So yeah, I'm cheering the Super Mario Brothers movie. Certainly a lot better than the 1993 one.
Bob Hoskins?
Yeah, I know.
Come on,
John Leguizamo. So
that's good. I heard a review that was like, this movie is 80% Leonardo DiCaprio pointing at the TV meme. And then the rest is just like colors. So it's like, okay.
It's for kids.
That's what you get.
Right? Like, it's a movie for kids. And once you go in with that knowledge, it's a great movie to watch if you played Nintendo growing up.
Yeah, and I haven't seen it yet, but Jack Black on social media right now, he's just like having a time. He's really like he clearly loves being Bowser.
And he leaned into this character perfectly.
Yeah, it's great. Yay for Jack Black. Okay, my cheer this week is that in August, actually, coming up this August, Kelly and I have been approved to move from this one-bedroom apartment in this building here in our complex to a two-bedroom apartment in a different building in the complex. But we're moving to a place with a little more space. And because we have only need of one main bedroom, we're turning the second bedroom into like a guest space slash where our office is going to be. And so
nice.
I'll have a little bit more dedicated space for like podcasting and computer stuff. And so it's very exciting to move, set up stuff a little bit more, and yeah, have just a bit more space to spread around. Like we'll have a spot for like a dining room, so we don't just have to eat on the couch every night. We actually eat at a table. So that's very exciting, and that's happening in August. So yay, moving. Alex Wan, what are you cheering?
It's been so nice here. So yesterday I went to sit on a patio
balcony,
and then I went to go watch the lacrosse game. So that was nice, getting Ooh. Out of the house on a nice day.
Very nice. And
getting some drinks in nice weather.
Nice.
The Roughnecks lacrosse, or?
Yeah.
Very fun. I've went to one Roughnecks game in my life, and it's way different than hockey. It's like a way different vibe.
It's just loud and music. And
so loud.
Yell bang, bang every time they score
bang,
a goal.
Bang, bang. Bang,
pew, pew.
Pew pew. All right. Awesome. Cheers, everybody. That'll do us for another week and another month again at Nothing to Fear. Here we are. Next week is May, and we are going to delve into 5 weeks of the top five most common phobias. So we don't know what all the movies are yet, but I'm starting off the proceedings and judging on this list that I found on fearof.net. So I'm citing my sources here. The top five phobias that are reported are: number one, arachnophobia, fear of spiders. Number two, ophidiophobia, which is a fear of snakes. Number three is acrophobia, a fear of heights. Number four, agoraphobia, the fear of open spaces or being in a crowd. And number five, a shocking entry on this list, but the fear of dogs with cynophobia. And I'm going to start there at the bottom of the list. Not because it's the bottom, but because it's the movie that came to mind at the top of my head. And we're going to go back in time a little bit. We're going to check out Stephen King's Cujo for Fear of Dogs.
I didn't know they made a movie of that. I thought it was just a book.
No, it's from, I think, the 70s or 80s. So gird yourselves accordingly.
Right.
I'm ready for that semi-truck driver.
I thought for dogs you were going to pick The Sandlot.
No, that's the Beast. That's too scary.
Yeah.
You're killing me, Smalls. Mm. All right. So tune in next week as we dive into some common phobias. I'm going to say goodbye right now. Goodbye, listeners. Thanks for listening. We appreciate you. Luke, would you like to say goodbye?
Goodbye, listeners. You are appreciated.
Alex Wan, your turn.
Yeah, same. Bye. Appreciate, those things.
Those things.
We appreciate.
You can fill in the blanks.
We can fill in all the blanks. Remember, listeners, they're just movies. There's nothing to fear. Thank you for listening to Nothing to Fear. Leave a rating and a review wherever you got this podcast. Every little rating helps us move up in the charts and helps more people find us and makes us feel good and lets us know we're doing a good job. You can also follow the show on social media. We have an Instagram. It is Nothing to Fear Podcast on Instagram. We're also on Mastodon. Go to @ntfpod@horrorhub.club to check out what we're doing on there. If you would like to support the show financially, you can head over to patreon.com/nothingtofear to give a little bit to the show and help us keep renting movies, getting equipment, and just generally making the show. We really appreciate everyone who gives. Once you've listened to our show, you can also check out what Luke is up to. He does two other podcasts called Really True Fiction and Liberal Soul. And he also co-hosts a radio show called Full Spectrum Cinema on Kootenai Co-op Radio. Check out those discussions on movies. They're a good, fun time. Alex can be found at One Song a Day on Instagram, where he puts a new song up every day. And there's an ever-growing Spotify playlist for you to check out. Once again, we love you so much. Thank you forever, forever, ever. And see you next time.